WTH Board of Directors, Associate Station Manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with Barbara Pritchard, local advocate, and Fran Tobin, an organizer for Institutional Rescue and Recovery Coalition, IRRC. But first, disability news for the week of January 24th, 2022. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Rochelle Walensky raised the ire of disability advocates after saying that it was encouraging that most vaccinated individuals who have died from COVID-19, quote, were unwell to begin with, end quote. Walensky's comment was made on ABC's Good Morning America, where she discussed a new study looking at the effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines. She said, quote, the overwhelming number of deaths, over 75%, occurred in people who had at least four comorbidities. So really, these are people who were unwell to begin with. And yes, really encouraging news in the context of Omicron. We're really encouraged by these results, end quote. Disability advocates say those individuals with comorbidities, like Walensky described, however, are people with disabilities, and their lives and the risks presented to them by COVID shouldn't be dismissed. The remarks caused an uproar on social media. Afterward, nearly 150 disability advocacy groups signed a letter to Walensky demanding an apology and calling for policy changes, such as factoring the impacts on those most at risk in decisions regarding isolation guidance, and to ensure that recommendations and response efforts are inclusive of people with disabilities. The angry reaction to Walensky's comments is the culmination of long-running concerns from advocates that the needs of people with disabilities during the pandemic have been ignored by the federal government. Bethany Lilly with the ARC said that previous outreach to the CDC director from disability advocates regarding access to vaccines and boosters, for example, did not get a response. Walensky met with representatives from a number of advocacy organizations on Friday afternoon to apologize for what the CDC described as a hurtful yet intentional statement pertaining to COVID-19 deaths and comorbidities. Walensky also committed to regular meetings between the CDC and disability groups. Social Security offices across the country are planning to open their doors again after almost 2 years, starting March 30th. Agreement was reached this month with the unions representing workers for the agency. However, the exact date could still change as negotiations continue and the situation with COVID is still fluid. Social Security closed its offices to the public in March 2020 due to the pandemic. At that time, officials said the move was intended to protect the agency's employees as well as its beneficiaries, many of whom are at high risk from the virus. Since that time, nearly all business with the public has been handled by phone, online, and through the mail. The Social Security Administration had planned to reopen its offices in January, but the move was delayed because of concerns from unions. Under the new agreement, all employees and visitors will be required to wear masks in Social Security offices, whether or not they are vaccinated. More than 69 million Americans receive monthly payments from Social Security, including 8 million supplemental security income beneficiaries, many of whom have disabilities. According to Acting Commissioner of Social Security, Kalolo Kajisazi, quote, I know the public will have questions about what this means to them. For now, you should continue to reach us online at socialsecurity.gov or by calling our national 800 number or your local office. We will let you know when we are able to restore additional services, end quote. After the Supreme Court struck down a Biden administration plan to require vaccinations or regular testing for workers at businesses with at least 100 employees, it appears that some workers supporting people with developmental disabilities across the country will still be required to be vaccinated against the virus. The court did uphold a mandate for healthcare workers at facilities receiving funding from Medicare or Medicaid. The rule covers healthcare workers, The rule covering healthcare workers includes hospitals and long-term care facilities, staff at intermediate care facilities, psychiatric residential treatment facilities, home health agencies, and other providers. But CMS said that staff at group homes and other home and community-based services settings will not be affected by the vaccine mandate because the agency lacks regulatory authority. The rule is already in effect in about half of the country, but CMS said that 24 other states must establish plans and procedures to ensure staff are vaccinated. According to Zoe Gross, director of advocacy at the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, quote, making COVID vaccination optional for direct support workers harms people with disabilities who rely on direct support every day. People who use HCBS may need assistance with tasks such as bathing, eating, or transferring from a wheelchair, assistance that cannot be provided from 6 feet away. Vaccine mandates make it safer to receive these kinds of services by reducing the chance that a direct support worker will transmit COVID to the person they support. The ruling is bad news for people with disabilities. Many people with disabilities work, and by eliminating vaccine mandates in some workplaces, this ruling makes it harder for us to be protected in those workplaces, end quote. The push to require COVID-19 vaccines comes as many disability providers have already struggled to attract and retain staff. And finally, a well-respected art gallery in Manhattan is hosting a rare exhibit by artists with autism and other disabilities. The Agora Gallery exhibit, titled Art Ability, features 140 artists. Said Raisa Martins, exhibition coordinator at the gallery, quote, even though we have some Salvador Dalis in the front, the most special art in the gallery is from them. End quote. Said Michael Bauman, whose depiction of the Empire State Building is exhibited, said, quote, it's a true honor for me. It's a big deal. I'm very proud of myself for what I've accomplished. The Art Center has made me want to do a lot of art because there's no mistakes in art. End quote. Bauman said Jackson Pollock is among his favorite artists. Bauman's mother, Michelle, said, quote, I think it's amazing. Just the fact that their artwork is being recognized, it validates them. He's very excited. We've seen with Michael that it's an outlet for him to express his emotions, whether it be joy or frustration. He turns to art, end quote. The 250 works in the show range from drawings and watercolors to mixed media pieces and digital art. And that's the news for this week.
Celebrate what sets you apart. Takes more than the color that you find on a palette to turn humanity into an art.
You are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, joined today by two guests on the phone, Barb Pritchard, who is a returning guest from a couple of weeks ago, and Fran Tobin, who is an organizer for the IRRC, the Institutional Rescue and Recovery Coalition. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
Why don't we start with introductions, and Fran, I'd like for you to go first, if you would, please.
Well, so thanks for having us on as part of the, I'm Fran Tobin, and I am one of the organizers with the Institutional Rescue Cult and Recovery Coalition. It was formed when it became so blatantly obvious that the death rate, the COVID death rate in congregate care settings was so extraordinary and required and called for extraordinary action, which unfortunately we didn't see. We're advocating around that. And I am also the coordinator of the Alliance for Community Services, which is a labor community coalition working on promoting, protecting, and improving the quality of public services that meet human needs.
Yeah. Okay, great. And Barb, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself too?
I'm Barb Pritchard. I'm a local Champaign-Urbana individual that I spend a lot of time working on disability rights issues and have for a number of years. I'm retired, but doing volunteer work and advocacy is my passion. I got involved with Institutional Rescue and Recovery Coalition a little more than a year ago. They hosted an event called Waiting to Die, which was a Zoom event, and talked about what the conditions were for people with disabilities and seniors in nursing homes. And they had a couple of guests that were from Pennsylvania and Denver who talked about their efforts to move people out of congregate care into a safe environment and, if possible, then back into the community. But the intent was to, on an emergency basis, move people out so that the nursing home might have a little more space for people to social distance, but all in all, an effort to save lives. And so I got involved with the coalition, which is, at that point was primarily Chicago-based, and I worked a little bit to pull some people in from the Joliet area and the Alton area and Champaign-Urbana. So we're trying to expand. I don't think locally, Vicki, we're having as many issues as some of the Chicago area nursing homes are having.
Mm-hmm.
But I know statewide, and Fran, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think of the 1% of people that are in congregate care, I believe it's upwards of 40% are dying in congregate care of the COVID vaccine.
No, not of the vaccine, of the disease, right?
I'm sorry. Yes, of the disease. I apologize. Not the vaccine.
You don't scare people, Barb.
The lack of vaccine.
Yes, yes. So what actions, what does the IRRC, what are the things that you actually do to advocate for this situation to change?
Fran? Well, go ahead, Fran.
So most of the work is, you know, first looking into options, and given the disaster that COVID has been for many different ways, but especially in congregate settings, looking at what are the things that could be done, and the fact that there are groups in other parts of the country that have been doing what emergency action is usually thought of. If you have a community that's flooded, what's the first step in an emergency? The first step is to get people out of immediate danger.
Mm-hmm.
If their places are dangerous to be in, then you get them out, you find temporary housing. Nationally, FEMA is supposed to do that. FEMA has, in fact, set up various kinds of temporary housing for folks who need to get out of a place of danger. And in fact, FEMA has actually built permanent housing in a few places around the country in a disaster. So the first question is it possible to actually move people from the greatest danger? And we've seen that, yes, it absolutely is possible. But then it's the question of, okay, so how does that actually happen? What are the kind of resources and what kind of both government and private agency action is needed? So the work we've done is first identifying, you know, what some of these options are, educating ourselves, the advocacy community, and the disability community around that, but then moving to getting decision makers to move on those. So FEMA was an obstacle, even though Category B funds specifically are to provide and pay for temporary housing for people that need to be moved out of danger. Nowhere in the country did FEMA actually activate their Category B authority they have, and they would have done if it were people not in congregate institutions that were dying at the same rate. But
what possible response could they have for not activating that?
Well, it's troubling. The general response, I think primarily these are evidence of the different aspects and how deep some of the institutional bias is that I think many of your listeners are familiar with.
Mm.
The first thing people said literally was, well, we don't want to move people out of their homes. And it's like, well, first of all, so these are, you know, they're called nursing homes, but they're not actually their homes. These are places that they're in order to get a certain level of kind of care. The second part is, so they're care homes, long-term care facilities. So therefore, it must be the safest place they could be. Well, maybe in some other situation, but in a pandemic, when shelter in place doesn't work because you can't actually do what sheltering in place is for other people. In a facility where two or three or four people are in a room, there's no way they can have the kind of separation and distance that reduces the spread of the virus. Places were not called petri dishes for COVID for nothing.
Right.
So I think this bias brought folks to think, oh, well, yeah, it's terrible, but you know, they're where they're going to be taken care of. Instead of looking at the data and realizing, actually, these facilities were the most dangerous places people could be.
Yeah, the numbers clearly show that.
And I think then the third piece is, so there was this blindness, I think, perhaps willful, I don't know, but this blindness to the idea that it is actually possible to relocate folks. And again, there's, I think, this idea of, well, you know, people are in these facilities because that's the only place they could possibly be. Well, obviously, we know lots of people that have successfully transitioned into a community setting out of one of these facilities, so it's not the only place they could be. And we've seen programs in other parts of the country that did relocate people on a temporary basis, providing the kind of support, PAs and otherwise, that were needed, and all those folks are doing well.
But it was...
We had at least one response was the idea of saying, well, you know, old people die all the time, so mm-hmm. what do you expect? Actually, a person said this to us.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is, again, part of the bias is that in a way of blaming the victims, that this high death rate was because of the people, not the place, and not the nature of the facility.
Yeah. But they were going to die anyway, so, you know,
right. Why
bother?
And we did see in Illinois, if you look at a similar population that has very similar health and underlying conditions profiles, folks that do live independently through the home services program, they had about 1% infection rate. More than that percent died in facilities. So it's not the people, it's the setting.
Yeah. Have things improved at all since... You know, a lot of people who are in these settings have gotten the vaccine.
Yeah, absolutely. The vaccine rollout, of course, was lots of different problems, but absolutely. Getting the vaccines out has made a huge difference. The infection and death rate has dropped enormously. So absolutely, folks are better off having had the vaccine. So the infection rate is still higher inside these facilities than in the surrounding communities.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have seen that many of the facilities have bopped in and out of what they've called outbreak status. So they keep changing what they can and can't do because, again, when you're in an enclosed space, if the virus gets in, it gets all over the place.
Well, but even enclosed space is kind of a misnomer because you have multiple staff members coming in and out every day who are exposing themselves to the world. So
exactly.
So anybody who comes in who gets exposed could potentially infect a lot of people because they work with a lot of people in the course of their jobs. Correct?
Yes.
Absolutely.
And they go from room to room and patient to patient, which doesn't help either.
Yeah.
And a good number of the staff haven't all gotten their vaccines. Some are not getting vaccinated. And that, I think, poses a danger to the residents. And I know from talking to a few people that have been in nursing homes, they're very nervous about this. They may not be at outbreak status today, but they don't know about tomorrow.
Yeah, let's take away the idea of a pandemic for the moment and talk about the fact that there are people who live in nursing homes that would rather be in their own home receiving supports and services there. And so is the IRRC working only based on what's happening with the pandemic? Or are you looking a little bit more long range?
Well, the IRRC was sparked by the pandemic and was really looking to say, people with disabilities and people in these facilities in any kind of emergency, this one or the next one, need to be given the same kind of emergency saving, the rescuing, that anyone else would get.
Okay.
So the focus is really around the emergency response, but it's also made clear that there are fundamental problems with sort of the nature of how some of these facilities are governed and how they're held accountable, what the kind of monitoring is. So this is related to that. One of the things that came out of this work that the IRC has been doing of organizing people that are currently in facilities is for the city of Chicago, within the city limits, there is supposed to be this ombudsman program that monitors health and investigates health and safety complaints on behalf of residents. And those ombudsmen were created because of all the problems that exist in these facilities. And as you said, in a survey, about a third of people who were answered a survey said they wanted to get out of the facility immediately on an emergency basis. And three quarters said they wanted to get out of the facility at some time on a permanent basis.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly, substantial numbers of people, if they had the option, a real option, you know, they would choose to be elsewhere.
So in
Chicago,
go ahead. Go ahead.
And one of the things we discovered was that the residents learned that during the pandemic, the ombudsman program for the facilities within Chicago was only half staffed. So they literally only had half the people providing the kind of support they're supposed to.
Oh my gosh!
And it turns out, though, this affects primarily people in the institutions that are in the city of Chicago. It's actually a state agency that's responsible for this. So the state head of the Department of Aging had decided that she wanted the ombudsman program to be privatized, and therefore the contract that the city was using, it wasn't going to cover the future hires. So the city literally left vacant positions that would have been health and safety positions, making these facilities even more dangerous. Currently, for reasons we really can't fully understand, the Department of Aging statewide is still trying to push that. So the IRC, with a number of elected officials, is working on turning that around, because at a minimum, these programs should be fully staffed and have the kind of public support that they deserve.
Absolutely. So the states that are doing this well, which ones are they, and what are they doing differently there than what's happening here in Illinois?
The two states that we worked closely with are Pennsylvania and Colorado. Colorado's got a model where they actually work with a resident of a nursing home, and they work with somebody who's maybe been homeless. And there's a couple of programs that end up working together, and they work, and at least during the pandemic, they were housing people in hotel rooms that otherwise would have been empty.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure people were not contagious with the virus. And then after that, they'd try and move them to somewhere in the community that fit their needs. And the person who's homeless served as the personal assistant and also got lodging. And it was supervised by a couple of different agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And Pennsylvania is doing something similar. And they've gotten very creative in how to get the funding and are doing it kind of county by county, or applying for funding here and there and sort of piecemealing things together. That's why we pulled together a group on the national level to do some federal advocacy. Do you want to add anything, Fran?
Well, I think that's great description. And so through this network of people around the country, we've been able to have meetings with multiple members of Congress. We've engaged in developing essentially what a model could be that Congress could be funding on an ongoing basis, and have had outlined with a number of other partners around the country, about 80 organizations, have signed on to this proposal that also would have FEMA retool how they operate in an emergency. So that's some of the advocacy that we're doing as well.
It seems to me that that FEMA has been the object of derision almost every time there is any kind of an emergency when it comes to how they serve people with disabilities. So it seems like an ongoing issue as far as I know.
Yes,
absolutely. You know, you may remember a while ago now, but Hurricane Katrina, mm-hmm. It was a disaster in many ways, and many people with disabilities were left inside facilities as there was a flood. It wasn't a pandemic, it was a flood. So you'd think it would be a little more obvious, and some of those folks were left there to die. And coming out of that, the Federal Department of Transportation actually issued guidance to all states to say every state should make some kind of plan for how you deal with people in congregate facilities during some kind of disaster. And needless to say, hardly any state did.
Seems that the Biden administration is putting more focus, you know, given at least the news for this week, more focus on community-based care and, you know, increasing resources for that kind of care. Does that give you any hope? And what kind of advocacy do you suggest our listeners take part in to help make those things happen?
It's absolutely a good sign that the Biden administration is pushing for more resources in that direction. You know, our coalition and Barb and others have long been pushing for more support and more resources, but also more personnel with more and better training, with more and better wages. You know, people who are personal attendants and caregivers need also to be, you know, fairly paid, which most aren't,
mm-hmm.
And get the kind of support and training that they need. So it's absolutely a good step that the Biden administration is shifting that direction, and I think we need to continue to promote, you know, making that actually happen, but also that as it translates into the local, ultimately, you know, people live in particular communities and in particular facilities. When it gets into the local level, we need to make sure that, that those federal directives and the federal leanings and guidance is translated into good policy on the ground.
One last question for you. Well, I do want you to give any contact information if you have a website or whatever, but one more question before we go to that is that a lot of people who are in a situation where they have elderly parents or family members who have disabilities, they really don't know other options. How do we change that? You know, I have an elderly parent and all I know is nursing home.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It's sort of been put out there as the thing one does rather than one piece of a much bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
That the federal shift in that will make a big difference. But I think we also have to do a better job educating folks in general about the options.
And I suppose more people who do that, who find alternatives to nursing homes, the more options people will see and they'll grow and so forth. So is there a website that people can go to, Fran, to learn more about the IRRC?
The best source is probably Facebook. There's a Facebook page.
I think we lost Barb.
IRR Coalition.
What was that again?
So the IRR Coalition on Facebook, the best way to get more information. I'll make comments about some of
it. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Barb Pritchard and Fran, Fran Tobin of the IRRC. Thank you very much. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.
Down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey!
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1